You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of January 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Islamic State claims that their reach extends to Indonesia. Indonesia takes them at their word. But are both perpetrator and victim of yesterday's attack exaggerating the threat? My guests John Everard and Oscar Juadiola Rivera will discuss that and the day's other top stories, including Al-Shabaab claims to have seized an African Union base in Somalia. The African Union claims that they have the wrong address. One of the world's richest countries comes up with an ingenious plan for shaking down some of the world's poorest people, and is the entire canon of Bruce Springsteen about to be rendered incomprehensible to future generations? The accelerating advent of the self-driving car. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are John Everard, formerly UK ambassador to North Korea, among other postings, and Oscar Juadiola Rivera, senior lecturer in law at Birkbeck University here in London. Welcome both back to the programme. We will start tonight in Indonesia, still assessing the cost and ramifications of yesterday's terror attack in Jakarta. Local authorities have blamed Islamic State, who have in turn been happy enough to claim responsibility, although by the organisation's demented arithmetic, it hardly seems a success. All five attackers were killed, two by their own suicide belts, three by police, while casualties amounted to two dead and 20-odd injured. John, first of all, it's always worth bearing in mind, I think, with Islamic State attacks, especially those that seem relatively low-key or low-casualty, that it was obviously intended to be much worse. How concerning is this occurring in the capital of the world's largest Muslim country?
Well, I think it's concerning in the sense that this shows, it's part of a pattern, isn't it? We've had first Paris, then Istanbul, now this. This is clearly part of an IS strategy to expand their attacks worldwide and to show that they can strike, if not at will, at least pretty close to it, whenever they want. Not so concerning because, as you just said, it was hardly a spectacular success. Five attackers dead. Not clear whether they got all the attackers. There were originally reports there were as many as 14 of them, though those were sort of squashed fairly quickly. Maybe there are a few still at large. And this was an attack that it now seems was months in the planning. It wasn't a kind of off-the-cuff operation that could explicably have gone wrong. Somebody put a lot of effort into this, and still it didn't really work.
Oscar, the coordinator of this has been named, at least by Indonesian authorities, as Barun Naim, who's an Indonesian believed at large in Syria. Is there a difference? Because whenever things are reported as Islamic State attacks, there's always that question of whether this was actually conceived, planned and funded by Islamic State in the territorial entity in Syria and Iraq, or whether it's just somebody who has picked up the idea and run with it. Is there a difference between those two scenarios, and does it actually matter?
Well, there is a difference. It does matter in the sense that, of course, you have the kinds of attacks that would guarantee some sort of territorial control. And that's the main concern for IS, particularly in the Syria-Iraq region. These other attacks are part of a sort of tactic that is being examined by some Islamic theologians and commentators, this idea that you just hide among the population, that you become one of the population, and then you strike at the population at any time. The latter, of course, is an ominous development, as was pointed out before. It's part of a strategy to make us believe that they can strike at will. And yet, we must hold on to the fact that, as pointed out before, the attack was, all intents and purposes, a failure.
John, how great a danger is there in the aftermath of an attack like this, dreadful though it is, and even more dreadful though it's obviously intended to be, of extending to Islamic State credit, though that seems the wrong word, that they don't deserve. I mean, not for the first time in the aftermath of this attack, we're hearing the whole kind of, overarching conspiracy scenario being touted by Indonesian authorities who say that this Bahrul Naim wants to unite Islamic State with groups in Indonesia, Malaysia and the Philippines. Do we run the risk of doing their PR for them?
There is a risk. I mean, every time you report on the activities of a group like Islamic State, you are, in a sense, helping them. Remember, this was the theory behind the preventing the IRA having the oxygen of publicity that Margaret Thatcher espoused many years ago. What do you do? We live in a free society. The public needs and wants to know about what is going on. And this is the price you pay. Do we give it credit, as you hesitantly say? Yes, I think there's a risk of that too. I have to say, I've been quite impressed with the media coverage of this. It's been almost universally scornful, it seems to be entirely the right tone, conveying the facts, but not suggesting that the people who perpetrated these attacks were in any sense successful.
The trouble is, though, this is one of those things where the media coverage can afford to be scornful because, dreadful though the casualties are, by its own lights, it was a failure. Oscar, what do you think? The media tends to lapse, and I think authorities tend to lapse into reporting Islamic State and similar organizations as these, evil, omnipotent organizations. Should we report them and discuss them more as just, dingbats and losers?
I think you're getting at something very important here. We run the risk of confusing ISIS with these sort of specter-like organization, able to strike at will and to plan from a centralized headquarters. That's not what is happening, and we should be giving details to readers and to our listeners about the fact that in fact they are appearing very impotent rather than omnipotent. The important news, the important lesson out of what has just happened is that the attack was again a failure, and to remark that is to strike precisely at the heart of what ISIS would like to provoke in us. They want us to fear them. We should be very, very precise in saying that they're not as powerful as they would like us to believe.
A failure, as Oscar rightly says. Important to remember, too, that this attack very nearly didn't happen at all. It started to emerge from Indonesian police sources in the last few hours that it was actually supposed to happen on New Year's Eve, and the Indonesian security forces disrupted it. So this was a kind of shadow of an attack, not the operation that ISIS had hoped to launch, just the remnants trying to go through with it, a complete mess.
Okay, well, let's move along now to Somalia, which from, I guess, the perspective of 2016, looks kind of like one of the first front lines of the modern jihad. That luckless country's primary jihadist group, Al-Shabaab, has claimed today to have overrun a base belonging to African Union troops operating in the country. Al-Shabaab said they now controlled the AU camp in the southern town of El Ade and had killed more than 60 Kenyan soldiers. Kenyan and AU authorities are disputing this as we go to air. Specifically, they're suggesting that Al-Shabaab have in fact overrun a Somali military base near the AU-1, and the AU troops have counterattacked. Oscar, first of all, whatever truth actually emerges about what Al-Shabaab have attacked and how many soldiers they've killed, at the moment we really only have their word for it, which obviously we should be hesitant to take. How significant is this? It seems like a fairly ambitious assault.
It did look like a fairly ambitious assault. It should be that should be cause for concern. Also, it shows that the African Union troops are far from having recovered control of the country, as had been claimed by some sources at the end of the year. So that in itself is cause for concern. Again, not knowing exactly what happened makes judgment difficult. But it is problematic that a basis was attacked.
I want to follow that up right there. You referred to AU troops being in control of the country. Somalia is one of those places where I do wonder if we're doing anybody any favours, and by we I mean the world at large, in thinking of Somalia as a country anymore. I mean, two breakaway regions of it, Puntland and Somaliland, are in fact more or less functional. They kind of work. They're fairly peaceful. They're really no threat to anybody. John, why do we persist in this idea that Somalia has to be Somalia?
We don't necessarily do that, and it's entirely possible that in the end a political solution will be found that formally divides the country up. We're not at that stage yet, but we shouldn't exclude it.
Why aren't we at that stage, though? Puntland and Somaliland have worked tolerably well in the circumstances for some years now, and Somalia, the rest of it, has been a more or less complete basket case for as long as anyone can remember.
Sure. No, two reasons. Firstly, we're not at a stage yet where you would agree on where the borders should go. Both Puntland and Somaliland tend to say they control a bit more territory than in fact they do. Second thing is that if you're going for an overall political solution, it makes a lot more sense to do so when the situation has stabilised, which right now it hasn't. And it hasn't largely because Al-Shabaab are being pushed back all the time by the African Union. The parallels between Al-Shabaab's situation and that of the Islamic State are really quite striking. Both are losing territory actually quite significantly to attacking forces in their heartlands, and both are trying in different ways to compensate for this by launching spectacular attacks, which of course is what the attack on the base, whichever base it was they attacked, was all about. Significant too, I just want to throw in here, that we are getting figures, probably unreliable, but figures of some kind, about the casualties on either the Somali or the Kenyan side. Nobody has said how many Al-Shabaab fighters died during this operation. I have a hunch that when the dust settles, we'll find that there's an awful lot of dead fighters out there too.
John, you suggest there are a similarity in some respects between the situations of Al-Shabaab and Islamic State. Oscar, I wanted to leap seamlessly from that. Can you leap seamlessly? I may just have done it. To the suggestion that for all the similarities between Al-Shabaab and Islamic State, that in a kind of, you know, Judean People's Front versus People's Front of Judea scenario, there is in fact a power struggle between them for influence in Africa. Al-Shabaab is said to have been exceedingly distressed, for example, when Boko Haram pledged their allegiance to Islamic State's black flag. Is there a meaningful difference in terms of ideology, outlook, ambition between Al-Shabaab and Islamic State, or are they basically the same thing?
Well, I tend to be more materialistic when it comes to these sorts of things, and I think that the difference there, let's begin with the equivalence. I think it is a very important point that they are losing ground. So in a sense, these two events, tragic though they may be, are, in a sense, good news, because they do show that these groups can be defeated, and that a concerted military effort, well planned, well organized, can do so, push them back. At the same time, it shows that there are internal divisions. You know, there is this monolith called fundamentalism, Islamic fundamentalism, and so on. But if you look closer at these different groups, there are differences. There is no convergence. That is also good news. It means that it's going to be much more difficult for them to organize as an entire force. It also means that the ideology is not as encompassing as they would like us to believe.
I would suggest, in fact, the differences are profound. I'm not carrying a flag for either of these groups, but Al-Shabaab, of course, an Al-Qaeda affiliate, are much less extreme than Islamic State. Remember, the Islamic State's declared aim is to exterminate all 200 million Shia Muslims because they're heretics before they even start on the Christians and anybody who has accepted secular rule in a Muslim country and therefore, in their eyes, apostatized. Al-Shabaab, by that yardstick, look almost sane. All they are trying to do is to establish the Wahhabi sect rules in the territory that they control. They have not said that they want to take over the world. There's a big difference.
Just to follow that up, though, John, there are 22,000 African Union troops in Somalia. Do we get the impression in this particular instance, leaving aside differences now between Al-Shabaab and Islamic State, that they are actually intending on destroying or defeating Al-Shabaab, or is this merely the rest of Africa just trying to keep them in Somalia, a country which the rest of the continent has pretty much written off?
The word that the African Union keeps using is neutralise, which of course can embrace a wide variety of final solutions. Actually, not a well-chosen phrase, was it? But you know what I mean. The There's clearly a military component to this. As I just said, they are forcing al-Shabaab back. Ever since al-Shabaaab lost Gizmayo in, what, September 2012, wasn't it? You know, they've been very, very short of cash, so unable to resupply, short of munitions and so on. Militarily, they're losing. It's not clear that the African Union's end game is actually to exterminate al-Shabaab. They may well be trying to force a situation in which al-Shabaab comes to the negotiating table under AU terms, and that some kind of deal is worked out. Whatever, the way that things are going in Somalia right now, I suspect we shan't have to wait much longer before we find out what the end game is. My hunch is that this plays out by the end of this year.
Well, that's a semi-optimistic approach to Somalia, which is not something we hear a lot of. A final thought from this on you, Oscar, and I guess expanding that point of John's, this is the beginning of 2016, which is the beginning of yet another year in which I suspect we're going to be discussing Islamist fundamentalism fairly frequently. Do you get the impression that any progress is being made? Have we learnt anything? Are we getting anywhere?
Well, we have learned that we shouldn't believe ideology as they try to feed it to us. We are learning that actually efforts on the ground, concerted efforts by countries, can neutralize or at the very least contain these organizations. And if that is the case, then there is some cause for cautious optimism.
Actually, I'll go for a final thought from you on this one, John. Oscar was there talking about the model of the African Union in Somalia. You were earlier discussing the similarities between al-Shabaab and Islamic State. Is there something applicable in what the AU are doing in Somalia that might work in Iraq and Syria? Obviously, this is going to involve foreign soldiers actually being on the ground, as it were, whoever's foreign soldiers they might be.
I would love to be able to think so. Sadly, I don't. I don't, because I think that in the end, al-Shabaab, wild, hairy and scary though they are in many ways, have actually got some kind of instinct for self-preservation and would prefer half a loaf to none if it came to deal-making time. I just don't believe that Islamic State think that way. These people are completely absolutist and will fight to the last.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with John Everard and Oscar Guardiola-Rivera. Coming up next, welcoming refugees the Swiss way.
How much information can you pack into a minute? Every morning, the Monocle Minute wings its way into your inbox, packed with the very latest news and views from around the world, all delivered with a monocle twist. We'll tell you what that new aircraft carrier means for Southeast Asia, why the next EU summit will be more interesting than normal, and what to look out for at an upcoming election. We'll pick out the latest retail trend in Latin America, analyse the aviation news in Australia, and take a tour of a neighbourhood that's on the up. And there's more. At the weekend, we'll review the best new restaurants, give you the lowdown on that art exhibition you've been meaning to visit, and dissect the best of the latest fashion week. See? There's rather a lot you can pack into a minute. Sign up now at monocle.com/minute.
You're listening to Monocle 24. This is Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with John Everard and Oscar Guardiola-Rivera. Now, of the many hazards for which any migrant or refugee must be braced as they begin their long tramp from the chaos of the Middle East or North Africa to the peace and order of Europe, being mugged by Swiss immigration officials must be among the least of them. Exactly such interactions have been reported, however, some refugees arriving in Switzerland being required to forfeit all assets worth more than 1,000 francs to set against their future upkeep. Oscar, first of all, this story has emerged from a refugee showing a receipt for his money to a TV program. Switzerland has responded that this rule has been enforced only 112 times in 45,000 cases. Is this, well, what do you make of this? I think I'll ask the open-ended question.
Well, the United Nations has already made the case for Denmark that these sort of measures are simply unacceptable, and they are in terms of international law. And even in terms of common sense of morality, there's something really wrong there. I want to believe that this is just a very, very small number of cases. The law, if it is being applied, should be disapplied in so far as it is incompatible with current international law.
The same or similar is occurring in Denmark, John. Now, Denmark claims in its case that it's just applying to refugees the same rules it applies to domestic welfare claimants, so that's all fair. Swiss law also asks refugees who do win the right to stay to pay 10% of their income until that reaches 15,000 francs. As a general principle, is it altogether wrong for countries to expect new arrivals to contribute?
Well, it's important to remember that if you come from a war zone, you're not necessarily poor. I mean, some of these people do have money. What is the moral position on this? I mean, it seems to me that it clearly sticks in a lot of craws, but there is at least some kind of logical consistency to the Danish position, that you should not treat these people better than you treat your own citizens. And if they have money in excess of the limit imposed on Danish citizens, then you should apply the same rules. I'm not entirely clear where the 1,000 franc figure comes from on the Swiss side. It appears to have sort of come from nowhere. The big problem here, of course, is going to be that the moment that the word spreads amongst the refugee community that if you go to either Switzerland or Denmark and declare that you've got above either 10,000 krona or 1,000 francs, they'll take the rest off you. Of course, nobody's going to declare. You know, within a week or two, this new rule is going to become completely unenforceable unless you're prepared to strip search all these people.
I suspect this thought may just about have occurred to authorities in Denmark or Switzerland. These people will go elsewhere.
Exactly. Yeah,
Oscar, is it just possible that that might be the idea?
Well, that's an interesting point. But again, as the United Nations put it, first, this goes against international law. Insofar as you know, when you work the details, the quantities, how much, and the percentages, and so on and so forth, they become A, unworkable, B, arbitrary, and that's the problem. And on the side of unworkability, yes, it might be the case that this is a way to make sure people go elsewhere. But again, if that is the case, given that it will not work because you know you just hide whatever money you want, what you have, or you say that you have less money than you're supposed to have. It will not be possible to apply these kinds of measures, on a wider basis.
Just to follow that up, though, Oscar, as a general principle, though, is it wrong to suggest that people arriving in a new country seeking shelter should make some contribution and indeed some sort of actual investment in a new life?
Not at all. I mean, as a matter of general principle, whenever one arrives to another country, particularly in that situation, and is able to contribute, can do so. But of course, the point made by international law and the United Nations is that it becomes the operational details of these sorts of laws become quite difficult to apply on the spot, if you can ascertain that people do have the means to do so, they can they can contribute, and there is no reason why they shouldn't.
John, again, looking ahead to 2016, this is another story which obviously is not going to go away. And these stories we're discussing from Switzerland and Denmark are obviously part of a general pattern of European countries now starting to raise their drawbridges. I guess the question is, Sweden has made the point that last year alone, 163,000 people applied for asylum. This is in a country with a population of less than 10 million. Are European countries, rich and fortunate and prosperous though they are, entitled to say that's enough?
I think, you can argue about whether they're entitled till the cows come home. They are saying that, and they're saying that loudly, and they're saying that under intense pressure from their own citizens. I don't know if you heard any of the debate in the Danish Parliament on these measures on Wednesday, but a lot of people were saying that their mailbags were full of angry communications from voters saying, you stop these migrants or else. And that's just what came to the surface in Denmark. The same will be going on across Europe. We were saying just now that the effect of the Danish, and for that matter the Swiss measures, is going to be deflection. I frankly think that the United Nations is whistling in the wind. Neither Denmark nor Switzerland have the slightest intention of rescinding these measures. To do so for their governments will be virtual domestic political suicide. And I think the result is going to be that other European countries will follow suit, and that this quite soon will become established practice.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we'll look at America, where U.S. Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox, with the double X, he must enjoy signing his name, has announced plans to facilitate the appearance on American roads of self-driving cars. In the next 6 months, definitive guidelines will be provided on what requirements self-driving cars will need to meet before being waved into the traffic. I have a slight advantage here in that I've actually been in one, or in a variant of one, in Abu Dhabi in late 2014 in Masdar City.
Yep.
And they're self-driving cars, but they don't go very far. They only go 800 yards, but they're fantastic. I'm really excited about this, especially since I never actually bothered to learn to drive myself. Oscar, first of all, is there a reason why I shouldn't be excited?
No, actually, I had the same experience. My sister used to live in Abu Dhabi, and I went there, and I thought, this is fantastic. This is the future that I expected when I was a kid, the future that somebody has stolen from me. So actually, I think we should be as enthusiastic as possible. Also, because the knock-on effects of these kinds of technologies are crucial. In particular, one specific technology called vehicle-to-vehicle communication. If cars are able to talk to each other and thereby avoiding crashes and so on and so forth, that this invention might be as important in security terms as the safety belt.
Well, U.S. statistics suggest that in fatal car accidents, human error is a factor in 94% of them. So at that level, the argument seems unanswerable. But John, when you actually look at where this could play out in the next 10 to 20 years, there are millions of people in America and all over the world, indeed, whose livelihoods depend on driving. And you have to imagine that the first vehicles to become self-driving will be things like trucks. There'll be things like taxis and possibly even fire engines and ambulances. How is this a disruption from which a lot of people's lives could recover?
Will they recover? Probably not. I think this is a rather savage version of creative destruction, yet another example of semi-skilled quasi-manual jobs going. We've seen it in manufacturing industry with the robotization there. Now we're seeing it in transport, and I doubt if this is going to be the last example either. Yes, truck drivers, taxi drivers, make hay while the sun shines. Your jobs may not be there for very much longer. We talked in the next 10 to 20 years at the in Las Vegas in the gadget show that I think is just finishing now. Ford announced they hope to have driverless cars on the road for sale in 4 years.
Oscar, how big a shift in mentality do you think that's going to require for people? I mean, people are happy enough to ride on driverless trains, as people do on the Docklands Light Railway here in London and elsewhere all the time. Will people feel safer in non-driven cars than they would with cars with some human oversight?
Well, as you just pointed out, human error is the main element in most accidents. I think it will take some time, but not that long. Elon Musk from Tesla is also saying that in 2 or 3 years the technology will be there and these cars should be in the streets. And yes, it will be difficult for us to adapt also in terms of job losses and so on and so forth. But we must begin to rethink our society in terms of that sharing economy, which is coming upon us. These technologies are not going anytime soon.
John, Oscar mentions there the sharing economy. At the moment, all the legacy auto manufacturers in the United States are claiming to be terrifically enthused about the prospect of self-driving cars. But should they be, or will these things, as so many parts of the new economy are, be things that people rent and share rather than buy to have their own, as their own? Will we look back on the era of private car ownership, 50, 60 years from now as actually somewhat quaint and bizarre?
I think we might well.
Yes.
I think we will be telling our putative grandchildren that, gosh, I remember when people sit and pull gear sticks and apply brakes, and they'll go, ooh, ah, and think, how quaint. What putative granddad.
We will have to leave it there, gentlemen. John Everard and Oscar Guardiola, thank you both very much as ever for joining us here at Midori House on Midori House. And that is all for today's edition thereof. It was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Aaron Duffy. Our studio manager was Sean Malervi. For the next half hour, Carlotta Rebello will keep you company with Monocle's international playlist. Marcus Hippie follows with the menu at 1900 and Emma Nelson with the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time on Monday at 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.